Epicure ahead of kicking off his...
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Dan Friedel tells us about one researcher's efforts to protect rare Brazilian monkeys. Dan Novak presents this week's education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Dan Friedel.
Karen Stryer is an American primatologist. It has been 40 years since she started studying Mariki monkeys in Brazil. At the start, she was working on an advanced degree in anthropology at Harvard University. She continues to study the animals today. Mariquis are the largest monkeys in the Americas. Stryer first started studying them in 1983 in Brazil's southeastern Minas Gerais state. At the time, there were only about 50 of them in a large land area 200 kilometers from the Atlantic Ocean. The monkeys were losing their habitat, or living place, high up in the trees. Humans were cutting down the trees so they could sell their fruit and wood. As a result, the monkeys could only be found in a small area of preserved forest. In the 1980s, many researchers centered their studies on monkeys and other primates, such as gorillas, in Africa and Asia. Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall were known for their studies of mountain gorillas and chimpanzees at the time. Those women said the animals lived in a male-dominated society. Fighting was common. One male gorilla would fight another to keep control over the group or take a leadership position. Males who lost the fights would be sent away from the group. But in Brazil, the Mariquis seemed peaceful. Stryer said the male and female monkeys were the same size, about 2 meters long and around 15 kilograms. Males lived close to each other and did not fight. The monkeys were friendly with others in the group. In some cases, the females left their living groups in search of a mate. "I love them. They are beautiful animals," Stryer said. Stryer said the Mariquis showed researchers that not all primates lived the same way. "I think they helped open that door to understanding better some of this diversity," she said. She does her research in the 950-hectare Feliciano Miguel Abdala Reserve. The area is about 500 kilometers north of Rio de Janeiro. In the time she has followed the monkeys, their population has grown to over 230. The females can only have babies once every 3 years, so growth is slow. Russell Mittermeier is a primatologist with the environmental group Rewild. He is who first introduced Stryer to the monkeys. He said, "Not many studies last for 40 years and are of such high quality." Stryer is now working to create protected areas in southeastern Brazil where the monkeys can get around safely. That means making sure sections of forest are preserved. She wants this to happen so the population can grow larger And so the monkeys do not disappear if there is a sickness. Several years ago, she said, an outbreak of yellow fever killed about 100 monkeys over a period of 5 years. Researchers are also looking for ways to encourage mating among the monkeys. In 2020, a relocation program moved some females into a protected area where there were only two males. The effort paid off. A baby was born. Once there are 12 monkeys in the family group, they will be released into the wild. I'm Dan Friedel.
Some educators worry students may use ChatGPT to cheat on schoolwork. The AI tool could write reports and computer codes. It could create charts that look like those done by humans. A growing number of American school systems have since blocked ChatGPT on their computers and networks. Kui Shi and Eric Anderman are professors of educational psychology and educational technology. In their research, they have found that the main reason students cheat is their desire to do better in school. For example, some students want to get a high grade, and others want to learn all that they can about a subject. The decision to cheat or not, they say, often relates to how schoolwork and tests are built and graded. It is not as dependent on the availability of technology to make things easier. When students can rewrite a report or retake a test, if they do not do well at first, they are less likely to cheat. She and Anderman recently explained in The Conversation how teachers can use ChatGPT to increase their students' desire for learning and prevent cheating. Here are their three ideas for doing that. The professor's research shows that students are more likely to cheat when school assignments are designed in ways that push them to outperform their classmates. However, students are less likely to cheat when assignments lead them to work together and center on learning rather than getting a good grade. Teachers can get students to treat ChatGPT as a learning partner. That can help teachers move their students away from competition and performance to teamwork and knowledge. For example, a science teacher can assign students to work with ChatGPT to design a hydroponic vegetable garden. Students could use ChatGPT to discuss the growing requirements for vegetables and think of design ideas for a hydroponic system. These activities are designed to improve knowledge rather than just earning a good grade. Research shows that when students feel confident they can successfully do the work, they are less likely to cheat. An important way to improve students' confidence is to provide them with many ways to be successful. ChatGPT can provide those experiences by offering students individualized support and breaking down complex problems into smaller tasks. Perhaps students are asked to design a vehicle that can use gasoline more efficiently than a traditional car. Students who struggle with the project could use ChatGPT to break down the larger problem into smaller tasks. ChatGPT could suggest they first develop an overall idea for the vehicle before deciding the size of the car or what kind of fuel will be used. Teachers could also ask students to compare the steps suggested by ChatGPT with steps from other sources. Research shows personalized feedback can improve students' self-confidence. ChatGPT can be directed to deliver feedback using cheerful language. If a student does something incorrectly, ChatGPT may start a conversation with the student instead of just telling them they are wrong. Here is a real conversation from ChatGPT. Your answer is not correct, but it's completely normal to encounter occasional errors. Don't be discouraged by this small setback. You're on the right track. I'm here to support you and answer any questions you may have. You're doing great. This will help students feel supported and understood while receiving feedback for improvement. Teachers can easily show students how to direct ChatGPT to provide them with such feedback. I'm Dan Novak.
That was Dan Novak with this week's Education Report. Dan joins me now to talk more about the story. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to be back.
Today's story was about how ChatGPT could be used to improve learning and prevent cheating. There has been a lot of concern that AI systems like ChatGPT may lead to more cheating. How can they be used to prevent it?
With all the concern about using ChatGPT to cheat, it was interesting to come across some information about how it could be used actually to prevent cheating. Some teachers think there's really no way to prevent students from using ChatGPT entirely, so it's all about getting students to use it in the right way. The two experts who wrote the original version of this story have a lot of research about why students cheat and how to get them not to. So, one way to limit cheating is by designing assignments to build knowledge instead of just getting a good grade. Also, group assignments limit cheating. So, by using ChatGPT like a learning partner, students can interact with the system in a way that has it discuss ideas about a topic instead of just asking it for the correct answers. That's one way the system could be used to stop cheating.
There was also a suggestion to get ChatGPT to give students positive feedback. Can you explain what feedback means for our listeners?
Yeah, feedback is information about reactions to a product or idea or some sort of task. The feedback is then used to improve that product or idea. For example, restaurants often ask for feedback about their food and service so they can get better and make more customers happy. So if a student writes an essay, ChatGPT could provide feedback for the student and give them ways to improve. And the system can be told to give students encouraging, positive feedback instead of just telling them what they did wrong. That sort of feedback is known to be good for learning and improving confidence.
Interesting. Well, thanks again, Dan, for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week, our series brings us to the events of 2008. It was a year that combined one of the nation's worst financial crises with one of its most exciting elections in recent history. In 2006 and 2007, the American housing market began to collapse. Home values had been going up and up. Now the balloon burst. People started losing homes they had bought with money borrowed on easy credit terms, loans they were then unable to repay. The hope was that the crisis in the housing market could be contained and that it would not spread to the wider economy. Traditionally, local banks would have suffered the losses on the bad loans. But times had changed. Big investment banks had been buying those loans. The investment banks then resold them as securities offering high returns. Credit rating agencies working for the investment banks had told investors that the securities were safe. Selling a financial product based on a large group of loans was supposed to limit the risk if a few loans went bad. That was the idea. But that was before millions of homeowners stopped paying their mortgage loans. Mortgage-backed securities became known as toxic assets. No one wanted to be anywhere near them. In March of 2008, Bear Stearns became the first investment bank to fail as a result of the crisis. Others followed. In September, Lehman Brothers, the nation's fourth largest investment bank, sought protection in bankruptcy court. Its failure only deepened the fears in credit markets. Toward the end of 2008, an international credit freeze developed. No one wanted to take the risk of lending money to banks or other companies that might have owned toxic assets. Some people feared that there could even be a global depression, the first since the 1930s. The United States economy, the world's largest, started shrinking at the end of 2007. The unemployment rate started rising. President George W. Bush's administration, Congress, and the central bank, the Federal Reserve, took extraordinary steps to deal with the growing financial crisis. Their efforts included loans to banks, automakers, and other companies. The aim was to rescue businesses that officials considered too big to fail. The bailouts from Washington were a decision that not all of the American people agreed with. But the people also had to make a decision of their own in 2008. It was a presidential election year, and the candidates were some of the most diverse in the nation's history. The Republican Party nominated Arizona Senator John McCain. At 72, he would have taken office as the nation's oldest first-term president.
So stand up with me, my friends. Stand up and fight for America, for her strength, her ideals, and her future. The contest begins tonight.
John McCain had been a Navy pilot during the Vietnam War. In 1967, the North Vietnamese shot down his plane and took him prisoner. He was tortured and held for more than 5 years. He returned home a hero. During the presidential campaign, he spoke often about his experience as a prisoner of war. His campaign message was, "Country first." Senator McCain quickly secured the Republican nomination to succeed George W. Bush. The Democrats needed more time to choose a nominee. The race settled on two leading candidates. One of them was Hillary Clinton. Her husband was former President Bill Clinton. They spent 8 years living in the White House. As First Lady, she held an unusually public role in her husband's administration. Later, she was twice elected as a senator from New York. Now she was trying to return to the White House, this time as the first woman president of the United States.
So if you want a winner who knows how to take them on, I'm your girl.
The other leading candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination would also make history if elected. He was a first-term United States senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. He was born in Hawaii to a white mother from Kansas and a black father from Kenya. If he won, he would be America's first black president. Blacks in the United States had been slaves until 1863. They were not permitted to vote until 1870. Women in the United States did not have a constitutional right to vote until 1920. And not until the 1960s did federal civil rights laws bar discrimination against either group. During the nominating fight between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, there was a lot of discussion and debate in America about gender and race. Some talked about the problems that women still faced in society and wondered whether Americans could accept a woman as president. Others talked about the problems that blacks still faced in society and wondered whether Americans could accept a black man as president.
I think we're ready. Well, I hope we're ready.
I just hear people comments, that'll be the day when we have a black man running our country, yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
Candidate Obama gave a speech about race in America.
I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a wild white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America, and I've lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional of candidates, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many, we are truly one.
Many political experts predicted that Barack Obama would lose the nomination. For one thing, he was still new to many Americans, while almost everyone knew who Hillary Clinton was. Also, she had many wealthy supporters donating to her campaign. But political scientist Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia said those experts did not understand the country's mood.
They underestimated the power not just of Barack Obama, but also the yearning for change and the antipathy toward dynasty. The idea that the Bushes and the Clintons would essentially control the presidency from 1988 to potentially 2016.
Hope and change became the messages of the Obama campaign. Barack Obama won enough delegates to secure his party's nomination, which he accepted in August, shortly after his 47th birthday. His choice for vice president was Joe Biden, a longtime senator from Delaware. But Mr. Obama's nomination was not the biggest news story for long. The next day, John McCain had a big announcement of his own. His running mate would be Sarah Palin. The Democrats had once nominated a woman for vice president, Geraldine Ferraro, but never the Republicans. Neither party had ever nominated a woman for president. Sarah Palin was the 44-year-old governor of Alaska. Few Americans had ever heard of her until she spoke at the Republican nominating convention. She referred to herself as a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
Some women said they admired her ability to balance work and family as the mother of five children.
I feel like she really speaks for me and represents me.
During the campaign, Barack Obama raised a record amount of money for a candidate, about $745 million. He became the first candidate to reject the modern system of public financing of presidential elections. Instead, he accepted smaller contributions from hundreds of thousands of supporters. His campaign made extensive use of the internet to collect donations, connect with voters, and organize volunteers. John McCain did not have as much money to spend. Something else also set him apart from the Democratic nominee. John McCain supported the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Barack Obama said he would bring the troops home from Iraq within 2 years of becoming president. But the top issue in the campaign was the economy. Again, Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia.
The fundamental issue in most presidential elections is the economy. It really is the economy, stupid, the old slogan from the 1992 Clinton campaign. When an administration has a positive, strong economy, they're tough to beat, even if it's a non-incumbent running. But when the economy turns sour, they're halfway out the door.
Barack Obama and John McCain agreed on at least one thing in dealing with the economy. They both supported President Bush's call for the government to bail out the financial industry. Many Americans disliked the idea of helping banks that had acted irresponsibly. But Congress agreed to let the government buy bad loans from banks and temporarily become part owner of some rescued companies. Supporters argued that the bailouts were needed to save the economy from collapse. In November of 2008, Americans elected Barack Hussein Obama as their 44th president. He received 53% of the popular vote. He won some states that had not chosen a Democrat in many years. A little more than 60% of voting age Americans cast their ballots, the highest percentage since 1964. Support for Barack Obama was especially strong among young people and African Americans. Many voters were emotional on election night.
I'm speechless. I'm trying not to cry right now. I'm thinking of my great-grandfather, my grandmother, and man, this is amazing.
Because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
But the election of 2008 was not the end of America's economic problems. What became known as the Great Recession would officially end in June of 2009, 6 months into the new president's term. But its lasting effects would continue to be felt all the way into the 2012 election season.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.